This is the third in the series of interviews with Dr. Peter Greenwald, Director of the Division of Cancer Prevention, National Cancer Institute, about the history of his division. We are again talking in Dr. Greenwald's office at the National Institutes of Health. It is December 12, 2008, and the interviewer is Victoria Harden. Dr. Greenwald, we left off in the mid-90s when we stopped, and I would like to start with the shift in leadership in 1995 when Dr. Broder resigned as NCI director and was replaced by Richard Klausner. Would you comment on Dr. Klausner's priorities as director and what impact they had on your program?
Yes. First of all, let me just say there was a short interim period when Ed Sondek directed the National Cancer Institute as acting director, and I thought he was one of the best people we ever had. He has a wonderful perspective and balance. He knows operations, research, statistics, and things, but so I liked that period. Rick Klausner came in as a very bright basic scientist, knowing a bit about clinical research, but more focused on basic science. So he was a very bright fellow. But a bit conniving, I think, as we found out over time. There was a problem that I never really understood, but he didn't relate to me from the beginning. I suspected some ulterior motives that didn't directly have to do with me, but I can't document whether or not that was true. But essentially what it amounted to was Barbara Reimer, who was a behavioral scientist and health communications and that kind of an area, was chairing the National Cancer Advisory Board, a major advisory board to the NCI. And Rick, I believe, wanted someone more like a National Academy of Science member, I think.
To chair the NCAB.
Right. So who we really wanted was Mike Bishop, a Nobel Prize winner, who was, I think he already was chancellor of the UC San Francisco Medical Center and Cancer Center. And Mike's a wonderful person and very well-balanced. Everyone likes him, including me, and respects him. Well, so when I was away, I was in Banff, Canada, in Alberta someplace, and in the middle of the summer, Rick announces he's dividing the Division of Cancer Prevention and Control into two parts.
Did he give a reason?
I never got a concrete understanding. It was, I guess, to build up what he called the Division of DCCPS, Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences, in which he put pretty much all the behavioral-focused things, like tobacco control, diet, behavioral communications, and he put epidemiology, that is the extramural grants management part of epidemiology, not the intramural part. And he had convinced Barbara Reimer to head that division, which took her out of the position of the National Cancer Advisory Board and allowed him to appoint Mike Bishop as chair of the NCAB. And so the division that I had been running was cut in half. Again, I can't document his motivations. He never explained it, but I sort of suspect he didn't care that much about cancer control or cancer prevention, and this kind of manipulation allowed him to get his other objectives.
I'd like to sidetrack you 1 minute here and just ask, this is a broader question that has come up several times to me. Is the reason people within the cancer community don't like cancer prevention because it doesn't have the same scientific cachet of winning a Nobel Prize? Or are there other reasons to de-emphasize prevention and emphasize something?
I don't think it has to do with the glory of it. Which is true of all clinical research, including prevention and public health research, I think is a combination. One, if you look at the establishment, the cancer centers, their funding stream comes from taking care of patients, being at the forefront of getting new therapies where some of their grants are in basic research. Prevention has always been fuzzed up with etiology, with causation, which are related, but they're not exactly the same. Prevention means doing something. And we had not had a lot of effort and success to build upon, especially in the early 80s. It's a changing picture now. We have had some successes that are clear that people understand, and you see a shift in attitudes, but it took 20 years to get there.
Right.
So I think it's people go where they think they can succeed. I think there's an issue that has to do with the reward system. How do people get tenure and promotions? And at our university and centers, it's things that fit into what their departments want and where they know they can get grants easily. Unfortunately, I think you get them easily when you're doing studies where already a lot is known, because your applications don't have as many issues that can be attacked by the reviewers. So, for example, if you put in an application in nutrition science, which is a very complex area, it can be more difficult because there are always little areas that you can't really specify as clearly. And so I think it had to do with a number of factors, but if I would pick one, I'd say mainly the rewards system for the scientists and for the physicians.
Within the Cancer Institute as a whole?
Well, yeah, and even across the country in many areas, right. And what doctors see as their role in life, which is you don't get reimbursed for prevention very much. Mm.
I remember that you were made to reapply for your job, as
That's
it
true.
Were.
Right.
And after they did a national search,
yeah.
Surprise, surprise, they discovered you were already the best person for the job.
Well, it was a surprise. In between that, Klausner set up a committee to evaluate us, head by Ed Resnick. And from what I understood, because I interviewed every member of the committee after, the report was written without the participation of many of the committee members and was sort of critical. And I thought that was going to be used as a wedge to not select me. But then they had a committee that was going to select the applicants, of which I was one. And that committee had very good people on it who knew the field. And they essentially told Klausner I was the only one. And there was one person way below, and all the others were not qualified. So he then selected me, to the dismay of the guy who had chaired his committee, this fellow Ed Resnick, who has since died. and you know, then Klausner went along with it. I mean, it wasn't a huge issue for him, I don't think.
There wasn't any personal animosity that you...
I don't think so. I mean, I think he had his own things. He one thing he respected was knowledge and debate and things, so I didn't have some problems I had later of saying, here's what I think. He was fine with that. And we moved our programs forward. He supported that. So once he kind of got what he wanted, I suspected he was okay.
All right. In this new position as the director of the Division of Cancer Prevention, it's my understanding you did not have an intramural program any longer. Is that correct?
That was another thing that Klausner did, and it wasn't directed at me personally. It was that there was a report called Bishop Calabresi. Mike Bishop, the president, was chaired it with Paul Calabresi, who was a head of oncology in Rhode Island. And their report essentially said NCI should be like the rest of NIH, where there's a complete separation of intramural from extramural, and almost as if there's some conflict if you don't have the separation. So Rick Klausner set that up, and that meant that the few intramural programs that we had were taken away. But it also impacted other parts of NCI, where epidemiology was set up separate, intramural from extramural, and labs were all put in the Center for Cancer Research. We've swung back a bit since then, especially as we get today into more and more team science, where you need people from different disciplines working together, and where the intramural have to work with extramural for progress, so we're swinging back. But that was more of a system of what's your values in science management.
Well, at this point, you apparently established a new organizational matrix structure time, which gives explicit attention to prevention science foundation areas and target organ research groups such as breast cancer, prostate, gastrointestinal, and lung. Tell me about this.
Well, what we thought through, together with a fellow named Arnold Kaluzny at University of North Carolina, who's an expert on management and business systems as they apply to health, and had actually led an evaluation of some of our programs, and at one point chaired a board of scientific advisors. So he knew about us, but he knew about organization theory and practical applications of it. So we thought we'd set up a matrix as a way of getting people to work together in appropriate team relationships and building up the basic nutritional science and also keeping the translational research and clinical research moving and focused toward end results. The basic structure was okay. The matrix part of it didn't work too well. And the reason for that was the way the government at NCI is set up. I did not have the ability to put resources directly into the teams in the matrix. The resources went to the different research groups, more or less like branches. Mm-hmm. And so we'd set up teams and we'd track them, and a lot of them sort of fizzled. And so we ended up more or less saying, here's what we need to get done, let's get it done. And the team matrix part of the structure was kind of soft and didn't help us accomplish a lot. So we still have the foundations of cancer prevention, the clinical groups, and they're very, very strong. They have wonderful people leading them, and they made a lot of progress. But it's not because of the matrix as a per se, as an organizational structure. We do that more or less by bringing people together when we need to, and part of it seemed a little forced, saying you need a team here, you need a team there.
Well, you also apparently added new functions, including a division of communications and a protocol office.
Protocol, I would say, I wouldn't call it a division of communications. Yes, and we get IND, investigation new drug application for the FDA. So over time, we've had 62 of them, and I think there's about a dozen or so active now.
And what is your role in that? So that's something people won't understand.
The reason is, there's a lot of basic science related to prevention, and this is in the medical applications in prevention, where we're developing new drugs, and we're getting other people to do it. Some are bioactive food compounds or drugs that have low toxicity that might be useful in prevention. When outside investigators do this, unless they're at a large cancer center, they rarely have the capability to take their discoveries and bring it into clinical study. You need a bridge. You need studies of toxicology, of safety, of efficacy. You need at least two animal models, like a mouse and a dog. And the kind of studies you need to do to get through the Food and Drug Administration are not the sort of things that you can get a grant to do. It's not original research. So we set up a series of contracts to get that work done. So if you are an investigator and you say, look, I've got this great idea, I've already shown in mechanistic studies in my lab that is promising, it's time for you guys who do clinical work to take it over. You have to make a bridge. You can't put things into people. And so often we would say, okay, we'll do that. We may help you by getting enough of the pure compound, by having placebo made up, by having it packaged, by having pills at different sizes, different dosages made, by doing the safety studies, the toxicology, by meeting all the FDA criteria and getting the IND, and sometimes with cross-filing, and we let other people cross-file on us. We do this as a way of keeping the research going, and without that, you wouldn't get into the human trials.
I wonder if any of the other institutes have the resources to do this.
Well, our Division of Cancer Treatment does this extensively.
Well, that's within cancer, though, I was thinking.
The others, you know, they come to us. We've had groups at NIH come to NCI and say, we need this, but we can't do it. You know, or show us how to do it or stuff to do. I'm sure NIAID and the Heart Institute have it, maybe NIDDK. The others don't. And the others, they tend to have a grants program and a small intramural program, and they don't.
And they don't have a bridge.
No, they don't have the bridge. Sometimes they'll pay for little piggyback studies, like a study of eye disease on one of our trials, or a study of cognitive function, or things where we're doing the trials with a big structure, and the compounds may have implications for other disease categories. So they collaborate, and we're happy to do that.
Well, I know,
but they can't do this. So.
I know that one of the reasons AZT was able to be identified for AIDS was because you had in place
right,
the cancer
right.
drug screening.
On AIDS, there were two basic things that allowed NCI to make progress. One was, you mentioned Sam Broder, the reason he became director probably was, we had the capability of drug development, and Burroughs, I think it was called Burroughs Wellcome at that time, was developing AZT, and Sam did the early clinical testing in the clinical center. The other was, if you go back to the 70s, it was retrovirus research, development of the technology, of the molecular biology, and that's what laid the groundwork for Bob Gallop to do his AIDS research, aiming at uncovering the agent, along with Montagnier, I guess, and the other work, safety of the blood supply.
But it's just very interesting how the great investment in cancer that was
yes.
started in the 70s has begun to pay off. But we're getting away from your division. I was looking at the names of some of your project teams, and
yes.
I thought maybe you could talk about some of them. Molecular targets for dietary prevention of prostate cancer, for example. What were you looking for here?
We have a combination of some hints from epidemiology that what you eat may affect either getting or more likely the aggressiveness of prostate cancer. High fat, does lycopene help or not help? So there were these different hints from, they were really associations. We didn't know they were cause and effect, so we need to study that more. And another even stronger thing was we have some major clinical trials going. Now, the prostate cancer prevention trial, which showed we could reduce prostate cancer by a quarter, but that provided probably the best biorepository in the world for studying prostate cancer, because we had biopsy material carefully collected on the control group as well as those on the drug, finasteride, and it was well documented with a lot of history about the individual. And so if someone now wants to study mechanisms of development of prostate cancer or other things about, say, PSA screening or something else, we had the material, and we wanted to open it up so that scientists from anywhere, as long as they met certain criteria and it did not interfere with the trial itself, would be able to do the research. And so we were setting up the biorepositories and all the data systems to allow research to move forward in a way that it never would be able to without the trials providing.
And that was for people who were getting grants, they could utilize this information.
Yeah, they'd have to come to us first. Some of them didn't always realize that. And get some sort of letter saying, we'll be happy to provide this to you, these conditions, and you can do your studies. And they would have to show that in their grant application, that they had the feasibility of doing their studies.
What about the HPV vaccine?
We didn't have a lot to do with that, because that was mostly Doug Lowy and John Schiller and Jamiro who developed the technology to basically take a larva to make the capsule of the human papillomavirus, which is the vaccine they developed. But we knew it was expensive, and through one of our programs, actually in the chemo prevention agent development, we were working with a group in India to see if we can make a much cheaper vaccine that still works through a subset of the colpentimers or centimers that are in the capsule of this agent. So that's still going on. In other words, we don't think that in most countries where AIDS is, I mean, where cervical cancer is rampant, that they can't afford the vaccines that are being developed now. Now, maybe the price will come down, but we thought some alternatives where it could be made really cheaply and would help. So we have another track related to that.
And that's still ongoing.
That's still ongoing. And then we also happen to have the pathologist who developed the Bethesda system for reading Pap test, Diane Solomon, who's world class. And so she has been involved in the HPV trials and Latin American things with Schiller and Lowy and Mark Schiffman is the other major person. It's just because she knows the pathology and you need someone like that.
What about the ovarian cancer prevention initiative?
Well, that's tougher. I mean, we have breast studies in ovarian. We're not that far along in ovarian cancer. There was some work on different kinds of models and different approaches to trying to study it with BRCA1 and 2 coming along. You know, there's an increase of ovarian cancer risk. So it's more, I would say, fairly early in the research. There have been studies of methods of early detection, because it's hard to detect ovarian cancer early. And so far, they haven't, I can't honestly say they've paid off. There these tests of different protein patterns in the blood and other things that are worth pursuing, but we don't have an answer yet.
But you don't have any chemo prevention or dietary links or anything like that?
There's, we know that birth control pills can cut the risk in half if you take it for a while. But there aren't strong new leads. That's been known for quite a while about birth control pills. And there's more work on biomarker development.
Would you explain biomarkers? That's something that I think is very difficult for people to understand.
Yeah, and I think even the scientists confuse it because there's not clarity of definition. So to me, there are a whole range of biomarkers. So you can have a marker being a blood test or a urine test or a saliva test or pathology test on tissue. That you can have a test that tells you about susceptibility. That
like the cholesterol test for heart disease.
That tells you both some susceptibility, but it's also on the pathway toward causation. It's part of the mechanism, LDLH. And that's better, because then after you prove that's part of the mechanism on the pathway to causation, you're comfortable that if you change your cholesterol, you change your heart disease risk. And so a lot of the later, more recent heart studies look at changing the lipid profile without going all the way to change rates of heart attack, even though sometimes now they still want to see that. And we're not that far along in cancer, but we do try to separate what's a marker of susceptibility, like might be your genes, SNPs. What's a marker of risk? Could be genes, but it could be other things, like in breast cancer. Have you had prior biopsies? Do your mother or sister, if they had breast cancer, your age at first pregnant, first full-term childbirth, and other things like that. Then we have markers for early detection. Carcinogenesis is a long process. We actually think the disease is not cancer, it's carcinogenesis. Just like heart disease, the disease is atherosclerosis, it's not heart disease, it's osteoporosis, it's not fractures. It can be decades, even more than one decade. And we're looking at, can you find it earlier? And if so, can you do something to change the trajectory so you don't get clinical cancer? Well, so one way to look at that is find some marker of early disease, precancer marker. And so we have a whole large program called the Early Detection Research Network that's aimed at that. Now, the big problem is that you have to validate those, and it's just as complex as drug development, if not more. You have to first show if you have a test that's potentially useful, can it be replicated by other people? can you do it efficiently enough at low enough cost and a large enough group of people that you can then study it clinically? Once you can study it clinically, if we give you some blind specimens that we may have from one of our trials, like the prostate lung, colon, and ovary trial of early detection for over 150,000 people, if we give you bloods taken 2 to 6 years before people got sick, blindly, with controls, can you tell us who's going to get the cancer? And then if you do that, and that's where we are, we're not beyond that at this point, should we then do a clinical trial where we randomize, you get the test or you don't, and if you do you have an intervention? Does it make a difference? Because if you can't do anything about it, what's the point? So there's a long, long process, but we have set up a whole major national program, a little bit international, but mostly national, aimed at discovering and validating biomarkers. And the first validation step is lab. Can another lab replicate it? Can we, if the test is developed in a complex, high-tech system, can you simplify it enough that others can use it and make a simple test out of it?
Is it ever going to be as simple as even the cholesterol test, where when I go and have a blood test, they tell me you need to get it down to this number? I guess what I'm asking really is carcinogenesis. I was thinking what you said before about how cancer is really many different diseases. The one thing they all have in common is this random proliferation of tissue.
Right.
But is it all so complex that you won't ever have one marker, even for one marker for each type of cancer? Or
I think that might be feasible. Now what we call a type of cancer is changing.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of types, I mean, that have the same histology. So when you start looking at the molecular level or pathways or genes, it looks almost like every person has a different kind of cancer. And then you have to focus down. People say, personal approaches, but that's not practical. Nobody's going to make a drug for one person. So I call it stratified. That is, you may be able to group people according to certain measures, probably molecular blood measures, and then I think that we will get to where you can detect early and then have some therapeutic options, both for preventing progression to clinical cancer, if it's pre-cancer, and treating cancer. So that's a big, strong direction. A lot of people call it personalized medicine. I tend to call it stratified.
Well, I was thinking the one thing that I think of right now is that the recommendation that people over 50 have a colonoscopy, and if there are polyps, they tend to want to take those polyps out.
Right.
And when they're not cancerous or anything, that they are
right.
More or less.
So if you take that situation, number one, we know that some polyps will advance to cancer, and we even can tell if the more advanced polyps are likely to, but you take them all out. And if you have them, you're more likely to get more, so those people get screened more often. A direction that we're going in early, and we're supporting studies of non-invasive methods of screening, which are mainly stool DNA, a battery of DNA. And the idea is that it can tell the probability of you having a polyp or having cancer without the invasive test. And then if it's likely that you have something, then you have the colonoscopy. The reason for that is people don't want to get colonoscopy. So even though we know it will reduce colon cancer by 75 or 80% or so, if you're not going to have the test, it won't. And so we think we need a non-invasive test that people are willing to do. And that's what we're aiming for.
Ah. All right. In 2001, you published an article in the journal Toxicology that reviewed the emphasis in cancer research from the 70s to 2001. And you noted the change from the 70s when it was etiological, discovering the cause, environmental factors, possible viruses, genetics, and But that this then was also the period that sparked this interest of the relationship between diet and cancer and the inhibition, the chemo prevention, things like vitamin C. Now, there's such large-scale trials that are needed to do these tests for diet and chemo prevention. You developed the Early Detection Research Network, and I wondered if you have some examples from this program as to how things evolved beyond the biomarkers.
Right. Well, let me take nutrition separate from some of the other things. In nutrition, we had strong hints, I would say, documentation that what you eat affects your chances of getting cancer. But it was imprecise information. We know eating more vegetables and fruits, keeping portion size down, and that sort of thing were helpful with getting exercise. But the data came from epidemiology, which mainly shows you associations. And on a mechanistic level, we only had, I would say, educated guesses or circumstantial evidence. And so we felt that we need to build a much stronger basic nutritional science program. And we've been trying to do that. It's working, but it's quite uphill because a lot of people don't see that as where NIH, they're focused on drug development more than nutrition. But so we've been building up basic nutritional science, and you have all the complexities that you would have in drugs. There's individual variability of how people respond to diet, how they metabolize things, what they absorb, and then the difference in the foods, and the foods are changing rapidly. That what you eat today is different than 20 years ago. What's available in the supermarket is different. It's going to be different again. And so we have to take that into account. And it's a moving target, but yet we need that. And then there were hints and some hype that some specific nutrients might be beneficial. Beta carotene first being sold to the public as cancer preventive didn't work. But we had to do a trial to show that selenium and vitamin E and prostate, same thing, didn't really work, but there was lots of hype about it. And so we started several major trials. There are themes. There's some in breast cancer, some in prostate, some in colorectal, some in lung, and each one has its own themes. And then there are early detection trials. Let me start with the early detection. So back, I think it was about 1991 or 92, we started the prostate, lung, colon, and ovary screening trial, PLCO screening trial. It had a little over 75,000 men and 75,000 women in. And the aim was to see whether the currently available tests would lead to early detection and lower mortality from prostate, colon, ovary, PLCO, and lung. That's still going on, and because it takes many years. It takes years for the cancer to develop, and this is especially prostate and colorectal as opposed to, say, ovary and lung. After diagnosis, it takes years, and we wanted a mortality endpoint, because incidence endpoints and early detection have biases. So that's going on. But at the same time, we set up a biorepository with a lot of annotation of clinical information that is really helping to open up this whole genomics age with
genomics. And when you say biorepository, you mean tissue samples?
Blood, mostly blood, but the DNA from the white cells, and it's all up in Frederick and carefully stored, and a lot of it's with participation of Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics and our staff. But people all across the country use it, and we're very open to that as long as it does not interfere with the trial and it's good quality work. So we have a whole system of...
Just to get it on the record, when you have a repository like this, uh-huh, and you have clinical information about the people, right, who did it, those people's medical records are not individually available. They are protected, right?
So that they're protected, and there's a whole informed consent process where they've consented us to do what we're doing with it. So yes, but if we start then with some other purpose that we didn't think about, we might have to reconsent, and it gets a little tricky because each of the places participating, for example, this place, there are 10 different groups across the country, they have their own institutional review boards, and the review boards might not all behave the same way. So you kind of have to deal individually. We want to do a follow-up, and the follow-up takes contacting people. Well, do we even have permission to do it? Some yes, some no. So there are always these kind of issues that take a lot of time and energy and care to protect the privacy and the rights of individuals.
I'll get that on the record.
Yeah.
Okay. Did I cut you off before you finished?
No, I mean, there were other trials. There's the National Lung Screening Trial.
What is that?
So we know that CT screening of the lungs in smokers can detect small lesions, earlier lung cancers. We don't know if that does any good or whether it might actually do harm. It could do harm because you start doing biopsies in someone with chronic bronchitis and mm-hmm. other lesions from smoking. They're invasive procedures now if you find a lesion, so that can do quite a bit of harm. So we have a trial underway of about 53,000 people who have a smoking history to see whether CT screening, as compared to chest x-ray screening, will reduce mortality from lung cancer. And lung cancer is a big problem. The treatment's not very good. It's only maybe 15% survival, 5 years. And we want to see if we can improve that. So we have this big trial going on.
And when will it be completed?
I keep blinded to these things because we have independent data safety monitoring boards that see unblinded data and tell us either this is never going to show a benefit, stop, or you've shown a benefit, you know, time to let people know about it, or continue the trial. Or
I see. So there's not necessarily a fixed period.
No. I mean, there's a power calculations and a time calculation for how long it will take to reach the endpoints that are part of the design, but the flexibility comes by having an independent data safety monitor. And that also adds this impartiality with good scientists and physicians looking at the data, making sure there's no safety issue that we didn't anticipate, and looking out for the participants of the trial as well as keeping the integrity and the rigor of design intact.
In September 2001, uh-huh. Dr. Klausner stepped down as director, and he was succeeded by Andrew von Eschenbach.
Right.
Would you describe Dr. von Eschenbach's priorities and administrative style and how it...
Well, I have a lot of respect for Dr. von Eschenbach. But he came in under the Bush administration, which wasn't really for big government. He was very close to the administration, to Bush himself, and was a very outgoing, open-minded leader. So he pretty much allowed things to proceed, encouraged people as they developed things. But there were never a lot of resources. So while we had gone through a period of increasing budget when Dr. von Eschenbach came in, not because of him, but because of the way funds were allocated to NIH and NCI, it sort of peaked and started on, in real dollars, a downturn of more or less a level period. And it was very hard to start new initiatives. Now, he tried to help us start the new initiatives. So that wasn't the point. The problem was we were in a changing climate, and which affected all of NIH, including NCI.
And with the latest economic difficulties that might...
It's going to go on. I mean, you know, and our current director, Niederhuber, again, continued, although I've had issues with him over large clinical trials. Yeah, we don't know. I mean, the new administration wants to support science more, but there's not, you know, we're in a huge deficit.
Absolutely. And when I looked at your curriculum vitae in the early 2000s, the administrative milestones seemed to take on a greater outreach overview characteristics than creation of specific new programs or what have you. And I wondered if you would tell me about how you viewed the last 8 years.
Yeah, I think to some extent it was harder to start things. That was because of budget and an attitude toward large trials, which I thought in the aggregate we're not spending a lot on prevention trials, but when you look at the individual ones and say how many labs will this one trial support, it looks like a lot when it isn't really in total investment. So we did more to build on using what we had going on, including the trials, for a much broader scientific agenda, which meant using the biorepositories and thinking about how to creatively use things, and also how to build toward the future in early discovery and development of interventions for the purpose of prevention. And we also were aiming at engaging a broader and broader part of the science community so they would become interested in prevention and training young people and working with people all across the country.
What do you mean by the private science community?
No, but not just private, academia. Mainly
academia. Okay.
Although we have a lot of clinical trials agreements and things with industry, but these are more often just for getting drugs, getting drug distribution, having placebos made up, and they're not really working with their scientists the same as we do with the universities.
I see. And I was intrigued by another statement you made. In 2004, there was a symposium on bioinformatics in cancer detection.
Right.
And I want to read you this quote and then get you to define bioinformatics and explain this potential. This is the quote. "We should note two very interesting trends in biomedical research. First is the trend toward technology-driven rather than hypothesis-driven advances. Second is a greater appreciation of the need for integrative science. Molecular biology has been largely influenced by reductionism, the attempt to explain all biological processes by the same explanations as by physical laws that chemists and physicists use to interpret inanimate matter. Now, with large amounts of data, we see the need for synthesis, understanding, and translational approaches. Hence the need for aggressive development in the field of bioinformatics." All right, that's a great
right.
What you're talking about.
Okay. Well, first of all, we have a lot of new technology that have been coming online in the past decade. Most of them developed by engineers and physicists and people in the engineering schools, MIT, Caltech, and that sort of place, Washington University, there are a number, but they came from disciplines outside of the usual biomedical disciplines, and those institutions are getting more and more into biology and medicine, which is very interesting, and I think they should. That's bringing with it, when you have high throughput techniques, for example, in genetics, genomics, molecular pathways, we're going away from what's always driven peer review, where you had to propose a hypothesis and say how you're going to test it, to we can get this mass of information and look at it observationally and see what we can make out of it, and that's going to drive where we go next. And so these systems were set up to look at mass, to obtain and look at masses of information, namely DNA sequences and things like that. And a lot of the resources of NCI, as well as other groups, have moved toward that, putting some pressure on the investigator-initiated pool, which is kind of sacred at NIH,
right.
And having, to some extent, more contracts, more cooperative agreements, more team science required, because sometimes these engineers, a lot of them are quick studies, but sometimes, you know, they don't know the biology, but they have to work with the biologists and vice versa. So we started gearing up for that. The other thing that happens, if you take a trial like an early detection trial and say it works, you have a couple of points of solid knowledge, but there's the in-between points where applying it to other population subgroups where you want to get a sort of an estimate of that. So some of that can come through modeling. If you look today at the need to lower disease rates and improve efficiency in healthcare, a lot of that comes from outcomes research modeling, modeling based on input from cancer rates, from population denominators, census data, from other health information systems. You can put that together and try to figure out how to tune it to optimize things in a massive computer integrated system. So you have information technology at that level. You have a need for standardization. NCI is a program called CA Big because people doing clinical work, they're not all using the same system and you have to compare it. You have to know what's going on so you don't duplicate excessively. And then we have similar approaches to cells, to trying to take what you know about cells. Of course, you have to simplify it, put it into a computer system that you can then, where you can move around how you impact different pathways and try to figure out what's going on and how you can either make a new drug or impact it or lower risk. So the information technology is it's affecting everything, and there's a whole broad set of definitions. I give you a couple of examples of what we've done. In the Early Detection Research Network, the biomarker studies, we are working with the Jet Propulsion Lab. Okay, so Pasadena, Jet Propulsion. Well, why? Well, and that's with NASA, of course. Well, the fact is that at NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab, they have professors all over the country looking at information, and they have to integrate it and make sense out of it, much as we do. We have these people all over the country. And they had a platform in their, I think it's in their solar system platforms. They have Earth, solar system, atmosphere. And so we felt that the work they were doing, the system of setting up their computers, was applicable to what we needed to do in biomarker research and to integrate the information in a way that you can look at and make sense out of it, where there's all these people all over the place doing it. And so they're a collaborator in that whole system. Then comes along something else, nanotechnology. Also means a lot of things. We're not deeply into it in this division. But in NASA, if you make something small, you can shoot it up in the air easier. Of course, they don't do that. They just put more clutter in their rockets. But also, if you make a battery and everything's close together, the battery lasts longer. But we have groups that are saying, well, can you encapsulate a toxic drug and make it go to a tumor with monoclonal antibodies and open up when it gets there? And it's using some of the same, more or less same technology of nanotechnology. And then there are lots of diagnostic tests that use it. There's downsides that are not well understood of, do you muck up the environment with some of these things? Yeah. Or do they get in cells in a way that could be harmful?
In October 2006, Dr. von Eschenbach moved over to the FDA to become its commissioner, and Dr. John E. Niederhuber became the new NCI director. And I know you've had some difficulties with Dr. Niederhuber, but would you comment on his priorities and his administrative style?
There was some sort of a problem with Crawford at the FDA, who had to leave immediately through a conflict of interest. So President Bush asked Dr. von Eschenbach to go take over the FDA. And John Niederhuber was here as a deputy to von Eschenbach and was then appointed to run the NCI. He had been the head of surgery at Stanford. He had run a cancer center in Wisconsin. He does some basic studies related to stem cells. He came in, no reasonable person to talk to on one-on-one. His priority was more discovery and less clinical research. It was as if we could just put all our effort into early discovery.
Discovery meaning basic research in the lab.
Basic research in the lab, yes. He also recognized, I think correctly, that there's a number of inefficiencies in our system and the way cooperative groups did clinical trials, and we had a program called SPORES, which were program project type grants that went from basic through clinical, and we didn't have a handle on all of it, again, information technology. So I think correctly he wanted to deal with that. we wanted new initiatives on sequencing different types of tumors and using that information. So he came in with a budget that was flat, things that he wanted to do and thought were important, and that did not include big prevention trials. So it was a time when we had already sponsored in a cooperative agreement, mainly with a group called NSABP out of Pittsburgh, a group that is one of the best that's ever existed in breast cancer research, I would say the best, who had done our breast cancer prevention trial showing tamoxifen reduced breast cancer occurrence by half, and a STAR trial showing that another drug called raloxifene worked just as well with probably fewer side effects. And we wanted to now test that drug against another class of drugs called aromatase inhibitors that, again, we felt had the potential, although we didn't know for sure, but the potential of cutting postmenopausal breast cancer by 70%. And this, over with our encouragement, a grant was developed and went through peer review. It did wonderfully well. And Nita Huber wanted to kill him because he wanted the money for something else. And he said, oh, it's not innovative science, something like that. Well, you never have innovative science when you're to the point of phase three trials because everything came before. But that's the final pathway to much of progress against cancer. That's where people benefit. And my attitude was, number one, for scientific reasons, this was a very important trial to do. Many women could benefit all over the world, and we needed to know. And we did not know which would be a better approach, or that some women might do better with one drug, some with another, because they have different patterns of side effects and things. I also had another attitude about budgets, that I don't think it's a zero-sum game, which is the way this was working. That is, there's a common attitude, if you spend money here, you don't get money there. And within the 1 year, that's true. But if you have a flagship trial that the public relates to, that Congress relates to over a few years, they understand that that's a good investment, and they'll support you. So if you say genomics over 10 years in a row, and they don't see a change in rates, or not much of a change, that's not going to help you build scientific field and progress to public benefit, the same as having some really good successes. So I was for the things that had the potential for a really good success. Well, this, after some internal meetings, which I was not invited to because he knew my attitude, I think. So it was a matter of top-down, I know better kind of setup to me. We had a meeting of the National Cancer Advisory Board, this one in June 2007, and I spoke up for the trial to his dismay, and there was retaliation after that, which is...
What kind of retaliation?
Well, I would name three things. It's hard to prove one-on-one exactly how I think it was. Number one, on my performance plan, which is called a Core Commission Officer Effectiveness Report, he had Alan Rapson write a sort of a mediocre report of how well you're doing. Alan had told me that he was doing it that way because Nita Huber wanted that. Well, that's inappropriate conclusion between the rater and the reviewer. It actually would be grounds for grievance, although at my level I didn't want to go that route. And the second thing is we're running a preventive oncology program, a training program, and I wanted to change it because I felt it had more recently been training epidemiologists and behavioral scientists, which are okay, but they're sort of crowded fields, and we needed physicians, and we needed to start bringing in physicians and engineers. So I wanted to change it. The guy running it under me didn't want that to me, because it would take a lot of energy to go out and attract these people. And neither of them pulled it out and said, oh, prevention is NCI-wide, I'm going to put this in OG. So we did. And there was another thing where the breast cancer trials I mentioned were aimed at preventing the hormonally driven cancers, the 70% that are estrogen receptor positive. And we don't know how to prevent the 30% that are estrogen receptor negative. So we were building a concept to get at that. And again, we wrote a proposal, request for applications. He pulled in and said, I know better, basically. I'm going to have another committee look at it. It's been stalled for a couple of years, and it's in another division that went more or less under Dean Singer. And so, to me, it's almost unethical to obstruct progress because of some personal feeling. You don't go that way.
And what was the final outcome on the original trials that you spoke up for? Did they?
It's never been done.
It's never been done.
The one big trial's never been done. No. We don't know, and we won't know. And it's, to me, a tragedy that we don't know.
Well, this, this is probably just repeating myself when I say that it seems to me that it's very difficult to understand why NCI isn't putting more emphasis into this, and I would just ask briefly if there's anything else you think that we haven't already said.
No, I think we thought a lot about how to move forward in the future, and I think there's several directions. We have to build on lifestyle and public health approaches to prevention. It doesn't necessarily have to be this division. There's another group that helps do that. But it does mean working with other sectors of society, that if you want to improve lifestyle, you may have to work with city planners so that people can exercise. They can walk safely, ride bicycles, go to playgrounds without worrying about safety. You might want to work with restaurant chains. You might want to work with school systems. So you have to look at what influences that. In behavioral science, I think we have to work with behavior of institutions and behavior of policymakers, not just individuals, where it's been. And so I think one big direction, and we know historically that things of that sort for a number of diseases have had the biggest impact. Engineering has reduced infectious disease more than a lot of other things, more than medical things. On the medical side, we have a lot of leads. It's just a matter of more resources. We know where to go. Of course, we may learn more about where to go, but we know a lot of things we could do that are potentially important, and we have to find out whether it will work. We have a lot of these trials that need long-term follow-up because that makes them more valuable, both for cancer but for also looking at other conditions, and because they are the basic resource, the biorepository, that allow the basic scientists to do their work. And the cost of long-term follow-up has to be accommodated. But it's very hard when you're under pressure of a flat and essentially declining budget in real dollars. And so we had a retreat about what are we going to say to the next director and what are our opportunities. So we thought about that, and there are many, many opportunities. Some of it's integrated. It's not standalone division anymore. There's a lot of integration of science and communication across disciplines that we're eager to do and to take part with our colleagues in doing.
In the last decade, you've been awarded numerous honors for your contribution to cancer prevention. Are there particular awards of which you're especially proud?
I'm glad to get them, but I guess I don't value awards so much as changes in rates of cancer and accomplishments. I've tended lately, as I'm getting older, to try to give the glory to younger people because it gives them incentives. So there are times when I've been invited to be on TV or where I'd rather ask someone else to do it just because they get such a kick out of it and it means so much to them. And I mean, it's fine. I like to do that. It's nice to get appreciated. But I don't think that's the only thing, really.
It's like in history, we are impressed by the awards that people have gotten, but what we really want to know is, what did you do that made somebody give you that award? Tell me the details.
Right, and I think, to some extent, even in choosing my career, if there's money in it, the private sector will do it. if there's glory, academia will do it. The rest is for us in government.
All right, looking back on three decades here at NCI, Can you take a long view and tell me how you think the Institute itself has changed?
Well, the whole body of knowledge in medicine and science has grown tremendously, and I'm sure will continue to grow in the future. It's far more global. While I'm impressed with what's been accomplished, I'm concerned that the U.S. in its education system is slipping. We have some of the best, but they're a small proportion. We're in a global world, somewhat a competitive world, although we like to collaborate. And I think that we could do more to focus on the next generations and making them strong. I'm optimistic we'll have progress against cancer. We'll continue to have some. I think the research on applications is behind the research on getting new knowledge. And the idea that you have a responsibility to follow through to public benefit is not ingrained in the NIH system sufficiently. So I'd like to see that much more. I think we have opportunities across disciplines. We're set up categorically at NIH by disease category. In prevention, there are a lot of things that impact more than one disease endpoint. Some of the things we're talking about, whether it's lifestyle or drugs, affect heart disease, affect diabetes, may affect cognitive function or some other things, eye, vision. And I think we need a better way of working together across categories and collaboration. When you have to go to every council before you can do one thing, you know, you get stalled. If they all look at what's in it for us, you get stalled. And so I think we have to think about the efficiency in our system, but also how to get a collaborative nature for the best public benefit. And I think we haven't done that adequately at this point. But I'm optimistic about the future. We see all sorts of opportunities, and they'll continue to grow. I think we have to do a better job of planning for succession. I think about it, and I've raised with the NCI Executive Committee, shouldn't a division director rotate off every 6 years and take a sabbatical and come back? And that went over with a clunk, you know, and they gave me all these reasons in bureaucracy, how your job's tied to it. And we don't always have enough depth of FTEs to have enough people that could just move in. We have a lot of places where one person's critical, it's hard to let them take off for a year, but yet it would be refreshing. We're better at bringing people in for sabbaticals. We do that all the time. We may have two or three all the time. But it's much more difficult for us to take our own staff or leading and say, okay, you can go off for 6 months or a year and come back. We're just not set up that way, and NIH isn't. I think that would be healthy, the way the world's changing. And I think we're giving a very difficult time for our young scientists coming along, to the point where many of them will choose not to go into science because the rewards of it are uncertain and years away. I see people, you know, they're in their mid-40s now before they get a grant of their own. And they have a tough time with housing, with raising their children, because we haven't set up a system that makes it easy and attractive.
As we come to the end of this oral history, I wondered if you were willing to highlight the achievements that you are most proud of over 30 years.
I would say number one is building a field of cancer prevention, essentially from zero, except for tobacco. And even there, it wasn't control. It was what causes lung cancer. Building it from nothing to where it's recognized across the world. I'd go to Japan, and young fellows would say, oh, you're better known here than you are in the United States, because they understand, and they're getting into the field. So we have a field now that's taken hold, and it will last. When I'm gone, we'll still have a field.
That's my next question.
Yeah.
Who will succeed you?
I don't know, but there are a number of people in this division now who I feel confident could run a division like this. And there are a number at some of the cancer centers. But that number is small. I wish it were larger. There are people coming along, but I wish we could have grown even more. And I think, you know, we have that potential, but it takes resources.
Well, back to the achievements. You said number one was creating the field, and
okay.
I cut you off.
Then I would say number two, within that there's a certain subset of the lifestyle where I think in the nutrition lifestyle, we really built it up from very little. In the medical approaches, did not exist. The idea from the lab existed mostly from Mike Sporn and Lee Wattenberg, but building a clinical field did not exist. We built that, basically. And I think that will continue to grow. It's much like the heart disease comparison of cholesterol and high blood pressure. Find markers of risk, bring down risk. So I think the field of cancer prevention is now rooted in science. It's rigorous, and it will grow. It's not yet fully understood very broadly, even amongst physicians, so that has to take hold. To some extent, we have many places now. We have cancer centers putting up prevention buildings, big ones, nice ones, some, few, but they're big. MD Anderson, Fox Chase, and there are others, the big program, Seattle. And so that's going to keep the field going. And we don't yet have incentives in society in the way healthcare is managed that makes it easy to promote prevention, or it's more or less misrepresented is the word. It's sort of cast as early detection as something you can do with a medical test, and doesn't have the broader concept of how do you reduce risk, improve health, or improve quality of life. So I think that's coming. I guess I'd like to see, I think we've done a start of getting young people interested, but we've got a ways to go. It's not enough. And I think another thing that's, it's not cancer per se, but the fragility of our planet's become a big issue. It's very important. It affects a lot of things. And sometimes people attribute, they try to make the case using cancer, saying this causes cancer, but I think while that's a lever, that part's not usually proven to the extent that it's stated. But the issues of the planet warming and getting more and more polluted and population growth affecting quality of life, they're huge issues. And I think addressing them will help cancer and every other category of disease and overall health. And I think we need to think of that for the future and for our children.
Is there anything else that we ought to say and get on the record?
I think you covered it. I think a lot's going to depend on the attitude of the NIH itself, how it evolves over time. Advanced technology will certainly be part of it. I think both medically and in terms of economics, it's a huge opportunity for this country, and we should stay in the lead and build on it.
Thank you very much for a wonderful interview.
Thank you, George.